The King James Bible is a cornerstone of our culture and our language. Whatever our faith, whatever we believe, we have to recognize that the rhetorical power of this book, and in particular its power to fuse history with poetry, connects at the most fundamental level with our own history and poetry. Those are the comments of Sir Andrew Motion, Poet Laureate of England from 1999 to 2009. I'm Emily Auerbach.
I'm Norman Gilliland. This is University of the Air.
The King James Bible celebrates its 400th anniversary this year. What led to its creation in 1611? And what did King James have to do with it? Who wrote it? What sort of influence did the King James Bible have in England, the United States, and the rest of the world? How does this version of the Bible compare to others that came before and after it? Joining us to explore these and other questions about the King James version of the Bible as it turns 400 is Charles Cohen, professor of history and religious studies at the UW-Madison and the director of the Lubar Institute for the Study of the Abrahamic Religions.
Welcome back to University of the Air.
Thank you, Norman, Emily. It's great to be back.
I look forward to being enlightened, as this is a subject that does seem to have some confusion around it. King James version of the Bible, 1611, in England, of course. What were the common people, the lay people, if you will, reading for their Bible before that? And wasn't there some real danger to translating the Bible if you go back not too far in English history?
Well, there's certainly danger for William Tyndale, who is executed for that. He is the first translator into English, and he's executed on the continent in the 1520s. What English people are listening to or hearing in their churches, and perhaps those of them who could have read it were reading, are really good questions. The authorized version, or the version to be read in the churches of the late 16th century, was the Bishop's Bible, which was the second commissioned by a king. The so-called Great Bible had been commissioned earlier by Henry VIII. But one of the Bibles in English that was quite popular with at least some of the laity was the Geneva Bible, which had been translated in Geneva by English expatriates who had fled the country during the reign of the Catholic Queen Mary. And the issue with the Geneva for someone like James was not so much the translation itself as, we might say, the footnotes or the marginal notes. So, for instance, on Exodus 1:19, where the Hebrew midwives are answering Pharaoh about why they did what they did regarding Moses, the note reads, "Their disobedience herein was lawful, but their dissembling evil." Now, the disobedience to Pharaoh, that is to say the king, is described as lawful. If you're the king, you may not be entirely thrilled with that gloss, and James was not.
And back to William Tyndale being executed for translating the Bible from presumably from Latin or Greek into English. Did he know that he was going to be killed for that offense? And then why was it then okay by the time you reached the Geneva Bible?
Well, he's executed for theological reasons as well, his doctrines of predestination. And, of course, in the 1520s, England is still Catholic and Tyndale is consorting with Protestants. So there are a lot of religious politics that are in this. But Tyndale and Miles Coverdale, who does another version, completes some of Tyndale. And Tyndale, by the way, does go to the Greek and Hebrew. Coverdale doesn't have those languages, so he goes to European versions of it. But in a sense, Henry wants to get ahead of the curve, and after he breaks with Rome, he then commissions his own a Bible for the church, the so-called Great Bible. So that now says, okay, it's all right to do it in English. And then, as I say, you get the Geneva Bible from these English expatriates, and then the so-called Bishop's Bible of 1568. So the King James follows on what people have aptly described as the first great era of translating the Bible into English, and it really culminates it.
We have to ask, sooner or later, why are those others largely forgotten, whereas King James is still being read?
Well, actually, in its day, Geneva kept going. Its last edition was 1644, and it was occasionally reprinted after that. Part of its appeal was that it came in smaller sizes. It was sort of the Kindle of its day, if you will, or a pocketbook, as well as its marginal notes, which gave people at least some theological education, though it was of a particularly Calvinist sort. The King James and the larger Bibles are meant to be read in the churches, so they tended to be in larger editions that you would read from lecterns. So for the first half of the 18th century, the King James and the Geneva kind of exist side by side. And then by the latter part of the 17th century, the King James stands alone. And that has as much to do with ecclesiastical politics and who finally gets to call the shots as anything else. I think it's important for us, because many of us revere the King James and think of it as this august work. Some people think it's the greatest work of literature in the English language. Is that the King James was not always the King James. It was, first of all, the authorized version to be read in the churches. It was supposed to be, you know, it's the monarchy's Bible. And that was its first purpose.
What difference does it make that King James was from Scotland? Did that matter at all in how the approach was taken?
Not particularly, though the king was quite a decent theologian in his own right. And so though he had nothing to do with the actual translating per se, he really is the one who says, okay, I want this, do it. He comes to the throne in 1603. Of course, Elizabeth has just died. She has no heir. The English bring James to the throne, and the succession has always been a vexed question. And the next year, because the English church is roiled on the one hand by nonconformity, by Puritanism, and on the other by remnants of Catholicism, there is a meeting of leading divines at Hampton Court in 1604 to sort of talk about a number of things. And one of the things, maybe the most important thing that comes out of that, is that John Reynolds, who's of the Puritan side, suggests that, you know, maybe there should be another Bible translation. And James seizes on that, and then they begin to lay out some of the rules, one of which, as you might expect, is the only marginal notes we're going to have will be those that will clarify the reading of the text or give a possible alternative, no theologizing.
When did the Family Bible come into its own as an institution? I mean, we're making a distinction here between Bibles to be used by theologians in churches versus the, I won't even say the common man, but middle class, let's say, reading Bibles.
Well, I think that's a really good question. I think in one sense, Geneva, with its smaller size, though it's still large by our standards. There's a wonderful facsimile reproduction that Lloyd Berry of UW's English department put out in 1969 through UW Press. And you can see it. That's still a hefty tome. That begins to anticipate it. I think the Family Bible, as we think of it, is more a 19th century artifact by the time you begin to get advances in printing in the first part of the 19th century.
Those are pretty whopping big, too, a lot of them.
Some of those, right, are huge. But in some sense, the Family Bible as a consumer good, I mean, obviously it's a Bible and it's a religious artifact, but it's also a consumable. And the consumer aspect of it is really a 19th century innovation when you get presses that can print far more than they could have earlier. You can reduce the price, and then individual families can begin to have them and make them, as it were, a part of family life, not just the Bible, but the Bible where you keep your family records and so on. And so that's really a 19th century issue. But it's also important that in the 19th century, in the English-speaking world, the King James is still, you know, for most of the century, hanging around. And it is the one that becomes, if you will, the first family Bible, which helps to explain why it becomes the King James Bible.
And who wrote it? How many people were involved in its composition?
Well, it has been said, I don't know by whom, it may be apocryphal, but I love the quotation and use it unashamedly, that the King James Bible is the only masterpiece ever created by a committee. And it was. The original plans were to have 54 people in six teams. The actual figures seem to have been 47, so they were pretty close. There were six teams, three on the Jewish scriptures, one, I think, on the Apocrypha, two on the New Testament, and they met separately. They were supposed to, at least according to the instructions, each person in a team was supposed to do a translation and then they were going to compare it. It's not clear that that actually happened. We have very few notes about what actually transpired over the course of events. But in at least one case, it seems that everyone would sit around and someone would present something or they would read from – they used the Bishop's Bible as a basis, but they also had the other English translations to hand, as well as Latin, Greek, Hebrew. I mean, these are extremely learned individuals. And then after they produce their various versions, it goes to a final group that sort of smooths things out and puts the preface in and so on. So it really is a committee. There is no single author, unless you want to say God, which leads us to other questions. But as far as human transcribers are concerned, it really is a committee.
And we know who the members of the committee were, most of them?
Yes. You know, various divines. Most of us won't recognize any of the names now, and I certainly can't keep them all in my head. But who the people are is well known. What we don't quite have are the records, or we have a few records, but not much of how they did it. Scholars would love, for example, to know why they made the choices that they did working with the texts that they did. And, you know, we can know a little, but a lot of the scholarly analysis of the text is by inference and comparing different translations.
There's a poetic quality to the King James Bible. I mean, was it decided at some point something about the rhythm and the focus would be in part on the beauty of the sound?
Well, this is really fascinating, I think, to me, in that, first of all, the King James has, I would say, very good literary bloodlines. That is, it works in a tradition that's set down by Tyndale. I mean, a lot of Tyndale's words and wording are still in the King James, and Coverdale's completion of that and his own figuring of it. So the King James is actually, if you will, in some ways, the great peak, the Everest, if you will, in the Himalayas. But there are others that lead up to it, and there are others in that tradition, the revised version of the late 19th century, the American Standard, the Revised Standard, that are in that tradition. The other thing about its poetry, which is what, you know, moderns like me really love about it, is that it was designed in its day to be a literal transcription, or at least to be as accurate as possible. In other words, the translators didn't say, well, let's sit down and write the greatest piece of literature in the English language. What they did was, let's get the most accurate Bible in English that we can. I might say, again, as an outsider and not a historian of English, that, of course, this is the English of Shakespeare. It's the English of the King James Bible. It's at a time, I think, when the English language has, to my ear anyway, a certain mellifluousness and, to be sure, a certain obscurity or lack of clarity at times that has been, if you will, worked or bred out of it over the intervening centuries. But again, at the time, it is intended to be an accurate version because, after all, this is what's going to be put in every Church of England pulpit in the realm.
It's still a bit of a bind today, no pun intended, for a lot of people. The difference between the King James with all of its obscurities and the Revised Standard, which seems so prosaic even when talking about the most, you know, spectacular goings-on.
And part of that, of course, is the fact that English changes, the culture changes. In its day, the King James may have sounded
equally prosaic, you think?
Well, if not prosaic, at least maybe a little academic. But of course, all the F's and all the ands, and by the way, the ands here, they're following the Hebrew, much of which begins with the conjunction. So they're trying to
and so and so begets,
right,
so and so, and
right.
So and so.
Well, or even the beginnings of lines where we wouldn't ordinarily put a conjunction. They're really trying to follow the Hebrew. But as the language changes, this now begins to sound, well, for a while to English ears, it sounds archaic. And then in the later 18th century, it becomes to come back into fashion again. So the poetic quality doesn't really get appreciated by many people in England and then later in the United States until the later 18th century and then the 19th century, at which time, compared to the English spoken then, this really does sound like God's voice.
Mm-hmm. And are there equivalent famous translations going on in French, in German, in Italian, anything where it carries the same weight that the King James Version does for England?
To my knowledge, the only version that has that kind of weight is Luther's German.
Which Bach would have used for all those cantatas and motets.
Yeah, and I mean, it's Luther, after all, so there's a certain theological cachet. And Luther had a very good sense of the vernacular German. I don't know if Luther's German has had that kind of effect on the German language, but I think that's the only other vernacular version of which I'm aware that has anything like the cultural impact that the King James has had.
Would the King James version of the Bible, 1611, have been accepted equally by Protestants and Catholics? Was there no controversy about it in that sense?
Well, Catholics, not at all. I mean, this Bible translation becomes just another part of a very bitter and protracted polemic. English Catholics do translate their own versions on the continent. The New Testament comes out in Douai in 1582 and the Old Testament in Reims in 1609, 1610. And it partakes a little bit of the English this scriptural tradition, but it's also very, very different in certain ways. Indeed, one of the impulses for the King James is the Catholic charge that, well, you've got all these English Bibles, so which one is it? Which one is true? And so there's an effort here to score a polemical point to say this is the English Bible as well.
Well, what would be some of the differences, though, bones of contention in terms of translation that a Catholic would say, no, it means this, not this?
Well, I hope later to read some examples. But one of the things is that the Catholic one is, for ecclesiastical reasons, translated from the Latin Vulgate, from the Bible of the Church. It does not itself, or at least the English, the early English translations themselves, do not go back to the Greek and Hebrew. Jerome, when he's translating the Vulgate, had to do that. But the English translations go, Catholic translations, go to the Latin. And so on that score, well, here's another point of polemic. How important is it to go back to the original languages? I think today everyone would agree that one should go back, and later Catholic translations do that. They may have the Vulgate to hand, but they will go back to the original manuscripts. But at the time, English Catholics translated from the Vulgate. So that becomes an issue.
We're going to follow the King James Version across the Atlantic to America when we continue in a moment with the University of the Year. We never thought from the beginning that we should need to make a new translation, nor yet to make of a bad one a good one, but to make a good one better, or out of many good ones, one principal good one. That's a comment of the translation committee that worked on the King James Version of the Bible, which came out in 1611. I'm Emily Auerbach, back with Norman Gilliland. Our guest is Chuck Cohen, and we're talking about the King James Version of the Bible 400 years later. At what point was it clear that it was indeed going to be the principal good one, the principal one?
Well, again, as I said, in the first half of the 17th century, the Geneva is continuing to be printed along with the King James. I think what really helps the King James is after the English Civil Wars and the Church of England is, well, eradicated for all intents and purposes, Puritans hope that they can establish a new national church on Presbyterian grounds. That doesn't happen. The Church of England is reinstituted as an Episcopal church in 1660. And at that point, to publish the Geneva would be politically dangerous and probably hazardous to one's health. So the King James then becomes basically the only game in town. I mean, the older versions and the older official versions have long since been superseded. The only major competitor is now, for a variety of political and theological reasons, no longer safe to put out. There are a few attempts in the 1650s by people to translate it, but they don't go anywhere. And I suspect that what happens is that as the English settle down and look back, many of them with horror at what has transpired in the middle of the 17th century, that they are quite fine to leave things well enough as they are, thank you very much. And we basically don't see on the Protestant side any concerted efforts for translations until the 19th century. I mean, there are updatings of the English Catholic versions by Bishop Richard Chaloner. So the King James begins to take on a long life where it basically has a monopoly of the English text. And that may say something about its own internal goodness, if you will. But I think it also has something to say about historical accident.
So King James Version of the Bible goes to Plymouth Rock and all those other settlements in the New World?
Well, to Plymouth Rock, I would have thought the separatists would be taking Geneva, though as I've poured through some American Puritan writings, sometimes they're quoting from Geneva, sometimes they're quoting from King James, sometimes they're making it up, or it seems like they're making it up.
It's hard to read.
Well, they're
light,
doing it from memory. It would have been taken to Virginia. But again, I think it's as the Geneva fades out that it then becomes the English Bible. Now, interestingly, the first Bible published in Anglo-America is published in Algonquin. It's John Eliot, the missionary, who translates it. You don't get a translation into English, a full translation, until I think Charles Thompson's in 1808. So again, for the 18th century, basically the field is held entirely by the King James. And in the colonies, there's really nobody who has the skill or the time, I should say, to make that kind of the effort that's required.
If you look at American historical documents, American literature, whether we look at Lincoln's Gettysburg Address or we look at other kinds of things that we think of as part of American culture, how important is the King James Version of the English language to what comes out in American culture?
Well, I think it is, as it is in English, just it's hard to avoid mixing metaphors, but I, in some ways, it's the spine, I think, of our expressive English. There are so many phrases, just coming up thinking of, through a glass darkly, or the power and the glory, things that are picked up by our writers, our artists, and that weave their way into common speech. I can't give you the figures on it, but surely the King James and Shakespeare are responsible for what we now consider to be the cliches of our language because they are so much the blood and guts of it.
As long as you brought up that phrase, Chuck, the power and the glory, I've got to ask you a question that may or may not be related to a King James Version of the Bible, but I seem to recall that the Lord's Prayer in the King James Bible does not have that phrase at the end of it, and that if you're like in a football stadium years ago, I suppose it would have been, where the Lord's Prayer is spoken, you hear all the Catholics stop, and then you hear from the Protestants that phrase at the end of the Lord's Prayer, "For thine is the kingdom, power, and the glory."
And well, that's a big dispute really over the underlying Greek and which manuscripts. I think most modern translations now feel that the underlying Greek is very late. That is, you can't go back before the 16th century to find Greek manuscripts that have that in it. Some versions will then add in the margins those, other authorities will read and give that. So that's an example of again, the translators trying to work from the best manuscripts that they have. But biblical translation to this day is still, can I say, bedeviled or at least complicated by what manuscripts you use. That's a completely other story and a very important one.
Going back to the original sources, or trying to even identify what they are.
And what are the original sources? And the thing is, there is no single source, either in Greek or Hebrew, that is the source. It used to be thought that there was in each case. And in Judaism, for instance, the so-called received text or the Masoretic text is for liturgical purposes the received text. But Hebrew scholars who now go back to the Dead Sea Scrolls and other things are painting a much more pluralist picture. So there is no single text, and that's
for Old or New Testament,
right? We have lots of different versions.
In America, in let's say the 1800s, how would ideas about the King James Bible have affected relationships between Protestants and Catholics? In other words, were there disputes between different denominations as to how the Bible should be interpreted?
Well, there were disputes, and sometimes they were deadly. They had more to do with whose Bible would be read in schools. I mean, certainly for Protestants and Catholics to argue theology and go to the Bible or to other authorities is not news in the 19th century. But what happens in mid-19th century America is a sort of collision of this new Catholic population coming over from Ireland and beginning to want to be educated in American schools, which are run by Protestants who have a generalized idea that using the King James Bible to teach reading, that the Bible should be used as a text to teach reading. And it's certainly done in the home and so on. And Catholics come in and say, wait a minute, that's not our Bible. And Protestants say, well, it's interesting from our perspective. They'll say, you're making a sectarian charge. This Bible doesn't advance any particular sect or denomination. It's the Bible. Yes, it's the Bible for Protestants. And in Philadelphia in 1844, in riots that ensue over these issues, you begin to 17 people are killed. And it spreads to New York, and the bishop rings some of his cathedrals with cannons and says, you want a piece of me? Come and get me. So these so-called Bible wars are very bitter. There's another set less bloody in Cincinnati that culminates in the Ohio legislature in 1872 saying, we won't have any Bible reading. The case goes to a superior court, which reverses it, and then the Ohio Supreme Court says that we're not going to have any. You can't use the Bible as a text because it just gets too contentious.
But we have other translations then by the time we get to mid-19th century America?
Well, there are certainly translations beginning to bubble up. Individuals, Alexander Campbell, who's one of the founders of the Disciples of Christ. We should probably mention Joseph Smith.
Yeah, I was wondering if you were going to mention him.
The Book of Mormon is, of course, its own scripture, but its language is very much the language of the King James.
Yes.
As if Smith feels that the appropriate language in which to render the revelations is what by the 19th century is deemed to be an august and poetic.
An authoritarian.
An authoritarian, mm-hmm. and also in some sense archaic and thereby revelatory language. So by the 19th century, you have the sense, and it's pretty widespread. Indeed, the sense that the King James is, for all its advantages and strengths, is not as accurate as it could be, goes back to the initial critics in the early 17th century. By the mid-19th century, it's becoming rather obvious with the new German biblical criticism and new attention to the original languages and an improvement in the scholarship that's available on the original languages that the King James is not as accurate as it could be. And that leads to the revisions of the late 19th century. The original plan is for British and American scholars to collaborate. That project doesn't quite work out. the British published their own revised version in beginning in 1881, 85, and then the Americans come out with the American Standard Version in 1901. But again, the sort of instructions there are to keep the language of the King James as much as possible and just make it more accurate.
But what's an example of something that needed to be fixed for accuracy? Like what would be a glaring error, according to scholars?
Well, questions about manuscripts, as Noreen brought up, what's acceptable, which manuscripts do we use? At the moment, I'm hard-pressed to come up with a specific example, but there are, well, say in Genesis 6, I think it's 3 and 4, early in Genesis 6, there are some passages that are in the King James almost unintelligible because of the manuscripts that they have to hand at that point. So what do you do with those things?
Difference between, going back to the Lord's Prayer for a second, trespasses and debts.
Yes. I mean, some of it is a better understanding of particular words, and for that matter, also changes in the English language, which make what was current in the early 17th century seem not only distant, but perhaps misleading in the late 19th.
We're going to look at some specific passages, such as Psalm 23, when we continue in a moment with University of the Year.
The Lord is my shepherd, I shall not want. He maketh me to lie down in green pastures. He leadeth me beside the still waters. He restoreth my soul. He leadeth me in the paths of righteousness for his name's sake. Yea, though I walk through the valley of the shadow of death, I will fear no evil, for thou art with me. Thy rod and thy staff, they comfort me. Thou preparest a table before me in the presence of mine enemies. Thou anointest my head with oil, my cup runneth over. Surely goodness and mercy shall follow me all the days of my life, and I will dwell in the house of the Lord forever. That's the familiar 23rd Psalm from the King James Version of the Bible, which is 400 years old in this year of 2011, and we're looking at it and its full context in this country and back in England, too. During this hour of University of the Air, I'm Norman Gilliland, back with Emily Auerbach and our guest, Charles Cohen. Well, if that is probably the most still familiar version of the 23rd Psalm for most people in this country, what tradition was it coming out of? What do we have to compare with?
So let me read from the Geneva Bible, maybe just the last two lines from that. Because as I said, I think the literary bloodlines of the King James are very, very good. And this will give us an example of that. So the last two lines in Geneva run, "Thou dost prepare a table before me in the sight of mine adversaries. Thou dost anoint mine head with oil, and my cup runneth over. Doubtless, kindness and mercy shall follow me all the days of my life, and I shall remain a long season in the house of the Lord." So substantially the same, if my cup runneth over is a famous part of that, that's there. Geneva says, thou dost prepare a table before me, thou dost anoint mine head with oil. King James says, thou preparest a table before me in the presence of mine enemies. Thou anointest my head with oil. My cup runneth over. I think if there is, to my ear, a poetic improvement to that. Also, if in line 6, I will dwell in the house of the Lord forever, which is King James, Geneva has, I shall remain a long season in the house
That's
of the Lord.
That's a little less reassuring.
Yeah. season doesn't sound quite the same as forever.
Not guaranteeing quite so much.
Well, the interesting thing is that other translations suggest it is supposed to be for one's lifetime. So as we go through some of these other versions, there's an argument within the versions there about what that means. Geneva's not alone in that. But I was thinking also poetically, again, and maybe I'm just so inured to the King James Version, which is perhaps our point, that I want to hear, I will dwell in the house of the Lord forever. And so a long season reminds me of Jim Bouton or some book about Major League Baseball.
It just sounds wrong.
Yeah, or a long vacation.
Yeah, and it's not necessarily wrong, but culturally it is.
And I'm trying to think, and I sort of detached way of the relative literary merits of these two. And I think even, you know, objectively, I'd have to say that the King James is just more succinct and it has a better cadence. This reminds me a little bit of, you know, the sort of thing a student would do maybe to avoid a plagiarism charge. You just kind of like change every other word to something that might or might not be as good.
Well, of course, the King James is coming later.
Off of this, I know, yeah.
And you know, some portion of this is going back to Tyndale and Coverdale. So, you know, we're talking about a family, if you will, that again goes, you know, into the 20th century. But let me read you, if you want to be jarred, this is what the English Catholic version, 1582, so it precedes King James. And there will be some similarities, but there are going to be some real differences because, again, they're translating from the Vulgate, and so this is going to sound much more Latinate. So in the Douay version, thou hast prepared in my sight a table against them that trouble me. Thou hast fatted my head with oil, and my chalice inebriating, how goodly is it. And thy mercy shall follow me all the days of my life, and that I may dwell in the house of our Lord in longitude of days.
Sounds like it was done by a lawyer. What does that mean, fattened my head with oil? How is that different from anointing? It certainly sounds less poetic.
That's, yes. I'm imagining that has to come from the Latin. And again, this is truer to the Latin, and you can hear that. I mean, inebriating, how goodly is it, is, you know, just out of the Latin text.
And what difference would,
at the end, sure. Yeah.
What difference would it have made sort of theologically? In other words, if you have the Catholics using that Bible, Protestants using the other one, does it matter with that psalm in terms of the interpretation of to what extent the Lord is with you?
Well, it might. Certainly, Catholics and Protestants in the 16th century get their dukes up over, I mean, the big issue is, am I saved by faith alone? And to what degree are works meritorious? And the Douay version really pushes the Catholic position that works are meritorious. And that comes through in a lot of the translations. I'd have to really think about this particular one to see if it works through here. But clearly, what words you use, even among Protestants, are going to have theological resonances. And that's why this is such a tricky business.
And then after the King James Bible comes out in 1611, what are some of the ones that come, you know, after that sort of rewrite it, retranslate?
Well, let me read you one from the so-called New Jewish Version. The Jewish Publication Society of America put this out a few years ago, just because in some ways you can – they're borrowing, but of course this is a different religious tradition, different translating tradition. And it's modern as well, with an effort to be as accurate to the Hebrew as possible, but also in modern English. So these lines come out as, "You spread a table for me in full view of my enemies. You anoint my head with oil. My drink is abundant. Only goodness and steadfast love shall pursue me all the days of my life, and I shall dwell in the house of the Lord for many long years." Now, that goes back to, you know, long seasons.
Yes.
So these they're finding that in the Hebrew, and, you know, maybe the King James at least took a version that is more poetic, but may not have been exact, or at least there's a disagreement among translators.
What about modern ones that attempt to render it in sort of ordinary speech?
Well, that's a phenomenon of the late 20th century, or at least the idea of Bible paraphrases, the idea that in some sense the King James and even those allied with it have become so foreign to the modern ear as to be completely unintelligible. And since the Bible was intended, after all, to be in the language of the people of the time, let's put it in the language of the street language of people now. So this is from, I think, a fairly popular paraphrase. Again, so it doesn't have to be a direct translation. This one is called The Message. So lines 5 and 6 come out like this. "You serve me a 6-course dinner right in front of my enemies. You revive my drooping head. My cup brims with blessing. Your beauty and love chase after me every day of my life. I'm back home in the house of God for the rest of my life." Now, for many of us, that is, I think, going to be very difficult, though I do like the way Eugene Peterson is the person who wrote this. "My cup brims with blessing." One of the things I like about the King James, of course, "my cup runneth over." One gets a physical sense of abundance,
right,
whereas with some of the others, the Jewish version, I think it just says, "my drink is abundant." You know, that's a statement about it. But the King James, you can feel the liquid overflowing. And at least in this one, my cup brims with blessing. I think it gets at least
just
to the meniscus.
Just short of overflowing.
Right. I think I can see the liquid, you know, just
brimming,
at the top,
yeah,
ready,
yeah,
to fall,
yeah,
over.
Yeah, different image, though. I mean, it's fascinating how just a little different spin can make such a difference in the way you react. Because overflowing means, of course, the overabundance, but it does have, as you say, Chuck, this very vivid sense of, oh, I have even more than I need.
Another really famous passage that's used in so many weddings is from 1 Corinthians, having to do with love. What do you find there when you take a look at the King James Bible and other versions?
Well, let me read the last 3 lines. There are, again, many famous and often cited passages from this one, chapter. But "when I was a child, I spake as a child, I understood as a child, I thought as a child. But when I became a man, I put away childish things. For now we see through a glass darkly, but then face to face. Now I know in part, but then shall I know even as also I am known. But now abideth faith, hope, charity, these 3, but the greatest of these is charity."
Is that from the word keritas? Is that where the love,
yes,
charity,
and
disparity
and that's,
comes in?
You know, the Greek that underlies that is agape. And
which
most,
is,
right, is God's love.
Fraternal love.
Yeah. And most of the more modern translations will go with that one. Indeed, even Geneva goes, "and now abideth faith, hope, and love, these 3, but the chiefest of these is love." So here, King James has swung, right. I'm sure that caritas, the Latin, is underlying it there, and they've chosen that one, and that's where we get Don Cornell songs and, you know, faith, hope, and charity. But most other translations have now gone back to love.
And we're just talking here a relative difference between fairly modern Greek and modern English. What is that phrase? How does that phrase "through a glass darkly" translate?
Right. Well, that's another. It's one of my favorites. I'm sure I've used it in papers at various times, because I have an image of somebody looking into a mirror, you know, and it's dark. It's probably Alice before, you know, the looking glass, or maybe the Wicked Queen before she comes up and decides to poison Snow White. So the New American Standard Bible, so this is the one that comes out in 1901, does this. When I was a child, I used to speak like a child, reason like a child. When I became a man, I did away with childish things. For now we see in a mirror dimly, but then face to face. For now I know in part, but then I will know fully. I also have been fully known. But now faith, hope, love abide these three, but the greatest of these is love. To my ear, in some ways more accurate, but also maybe faith, hope, love abide these three, which, you know, actually goes back in some sense to Geneva, sounds a little awkward.
What about some of the more modern versions of the same passage?
The contemporary English version plays a little looser. When we were children, we thought and reasoned as children do, but when we grew up, we quit our childish ways. Now all we can see of God is like a cloudy picture in a mirror. Later we will see him face to face. We don't know everything, but then we will, just as God completely understands us. For now there are faith, hope, and love, but of these three, the greatest is love. And I think what I'm wrestling with as I listen to these is that the King James is a bit hard to get, the sense that, you know,
it's mysterious.
It is mysterious. As some people have said about some passages, is beautiful. What does it mean? Now we see through a glass darkly, but then face to face. Okay, then, so
yes,
when is then?
Yes, you have to do a little bit of that,
yeah.
Don't you?
Now I know in part, but then shall I know even also, even as also I am known. So there is an improvement. Let me give you another modern one, the New American Bible. When I was a child, I used to talk as a child, think as a child, reason as a child. When I became a man, I put aside childish things. At present, we see indistinctly as in a mirror, but then face to face. At present, I know partially. Then I shall know fully as I am fully known. So faith, hope, love remain these three, but the greatest of these is love. So as translators, you are faced with the task of imparting the meaning. And also, I think the King James and the tradition out of which it comes and of which I think it's the greatest exemplar does urge many translators to try to be as literary as they can be. But literary standards change over the centuries.
But that being said, is the King James Bible still the one that has the most printings?
I think it does. And for some people, it has become not just the English translation, but in a sense revealed by God, that it has a special providential quality to it. For some evangelicals, this is still the Bible of choice. There are Mormon study Bibles that have the Book of Mormon in the same binding with the King James, so that Mormons can study. I mean, the Old and New Testaments are canonical for Mormons as well, but here's a study edition, and it's the King James that is the modern study edition. As I like to tease, you know, for some people, God dictated the Bible into the King James English, from which it was translated into Hebrew and Greek.
Well, and 400 years later, still very powerful. Thanks for being our guide through the King James Version of the Bible.
Thank you.
I'm Emily Auerbach with Norman Gilliland, hoping you'll join us for the next hour of University of the Year.